Hello, and welcome to our special series of Green Elephant interviews during March 2021, supporting the annual B Corps month. B Corporations, or B Corps for short, are businesses that meet the highest standards of verified social and environmental performance, public transparency, and legal accountability to balance profit and purpose. Throughout March, we are chatting with key people in companies which have chosen to certify as B Corps and become a force for good. Today, I've been joined by Ben Pekatic from Dynamic 4. Dynamic 4 are a Sydney-based social enterprise that works with people to build businesses, products, services for a happier future. They've been a certified B Corporation for 5 years. Ben Pekatic is a designer, innovator, innovation coach, and founder of Dynamic 4. So welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I noticed when doing a bit of reading up about this that you've got a lot of roles. You do a lot of stuff. If I look at the other people I've spoken to, they are the founder of the business, or they're the sustainability leader, or whatever. They do one thing, and looking at your profile, you do about a dozen different things. So the question is, how do you find the time?
Yep, we've all got the same amount of time. It's just how we prioritize. And while there's quite a few things in play, they all hang together and are, you know, multiple facets of the same core thing, really. So the purpose and the theory of change is at the center of everything, and then different ways of executing on that is the many, many hats I wear in different contexts, but they all relate back to the same thing, thankfully.
Yeah. So I did notice that you were involved in all sorts of, you know, kind of social initiatives. There were some sort of, you know, group leaderships, and there was obviously some organizations that you're involved in, and they're all around social change. Is that correct?
Yeah, so social environmental change and, you know, sort of social enterprise and social impact only has the social part of it in the name, but it's, if we don't have a awesome place to live with clean air and water and, you know, that sustainability and that environmental action, then you don't get the social. So to me, the social and environmental are 100% entwined. Long after, you know, we might not be here at some point in a hopefully very distant future.
Yep.
It's extremely likely the rock will still be here.
From
a sustainability point of view.
Yeah, it will still be here.
It's just mostly about us having a home.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. And so the social part of that, are you particularly focused on a particular, you know, aspect of society, or is there some change you're particularly area you're particularly keen on?
There's definitely areas that I tend to focus on more and do more work in, but ultimately I'm focused on and really fascinated by and interested in systems change. So looking at whole systems and how they map out and the different people and the roles they play and what they're trying to get done, what's important to them. And that then covers, you know, kind of everything. So, and do a lot of work with early stage social enterprise founders.
Okay.
And, you know, so they're looking at things across a whole range of social environmental issues and opportunities. So I get to have lots of fun by working with them and coaching them through that process, and then get to play with all the things as opposed to and across the various parts of systems and different levers and approaches, and doing that in a very human-centered design way. So, you know, looking at the people and deeply understanding and building empathy with the people who are in the mix, and then helping them, you know, come into that process to co-design their own solutions as part of that process, rather than kind of the "you're broken, I'm going to fix you" approach, which has often got us into much more trouble than we started
with.
And a lot of the things that we're trying to unwind, both, you know, especially from a social context, that's often been that approach of "we know best, so we'll fix you," has caused a lot of harm and negative impact.
Yeah. So you're obviously doing a lot of roles now, and you obviously like to have your hands on a lot of different stuff. And I noticed that your background has been quite varied as well. You've been around, and you've been over here in the UK in London.
So, yep, spent 7 years in London.
Tell us about that kind of, you know, journey, because I think it's really interesting that you kind of got all these bits to you, and then that's brought you to what we'll talk about in a second, which is Dynamic Four. So what was, well, let's talk about London. You were in London. What were you doing in London?
So, yeah, I moved over 2001, and I got there. A big part of the reason I moved to London, I'm a massive music lover. I'm not a musician, but I'm a massive music lover. And okay. So one of the main reasons I came to went to live in London was to be able to go to the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland every year. And so that was a big part of, and then just so many awesome gigs.
Are you a jazz fan?
I love jazz, but Montreux Jazz is obviously jazz, but the way I normally describe it, it's also all the different styles of music and genres of music that inform jazz and that were influenced and informed by jazz. So a lot of hip-hop and trip-hop and acid jazz and a bit of house, and as well as sort of roots and reggae. So you get a pretty broad spectrum at Montreux. It's fun few weeks.
Well, I did my undergraduate degree at the Royal College of Music, so and I've played all sorts of jazz and all sorts of venues and gigs around the world. So I understand.
Not to dig into that story.
Yeah, I understand.
Nice
understand.
To see you instead.
Yeah, well, maybe one day. But yeah, I completely understand. London's a great melting pot for all kinds of musical genres. So yeah, great for the music. So so you came for the music and you stayed for.
Yeah, so, you know, coming over for, you know, to be able to, the music and then travel. Mm. Being based in London is an awesome spot to sort of discover Europe and spend a bunch of time around Europe. So I had a fun 7 years, and I started Dynamic Four, a couple of months after I got there. So went to Montreux, got there just in time for Montreux, spent sort of 5 weeks hanging around Switzerland and France, and then went back to find a job. And the job market had crashed earlier that year.
Yeah.
And so there was just nothing going. So it's like, well, I'll just do my own thing then. And that's the birth of Dynamic Four.
Okay. And I guess that I'm really interested about that early, you know, 2000s for a social enterprise doing these things. That is early. I mean, we kind of take it not for granted, because, you know, there aren't a huge amount of social enterprises, but it's more common now than it was 20 years ago. And so
and Dynamic Four didn't start as a social enterprise. So the purpose, you know, always very values aligned, and would only do certain type of work with certain clients. So always had kind of that filter on the work that we do. But the purpose, the original purpose, was really about freedom for me. So having a business that was dynamic and would then allow me to explore lots of different things. So I was also, alongside doing what we currently do, I also used to be a personal trainer and teach Pilates and spin and stuff as well. So back in the day, there used to be Dynamic Four Fitness, and then there was Dynamic Four Technology as well, were the two original. And then did have ambitions of Dynamic Four Scuba and Dynamic Four Snowboarding. But those last ones I did, but didn't spend enough time overseas being able to turn that into a business, unfortunately.
So you were going to become like Virgin and just brand everything. So I was going to ask about the name Dynamic Four. So it really was a kind of a pre for lots of other businesses. So Dynamic Four Fitness, it makes sense if you add the fitness on the back. And is that purely why you chose the Dynamic Four name, is because you could then, you know, apply it to lots of different business areas and so on?
Exactly, yes. So having that sort of baked in as, you know, sort of a business and products brand architecture that could then have the other subparts off. It actually started as Dynamic Future Solutions, which is a really long name and a very long domain name and email.
It's a lot of typing.
That's a lot of typing with a couple of words that people notoriously misspell as well.
Yeah.
Dynamic 4 was then kind of the abbreviated domain name, and became, you know, the name sort of traded under. So, and that happened, you know, sort of within the first year. So it's, okay. And then it's, you know, kind of at the moment, it's sort of mostly Dynamic 4 Coaching and Dynamic 4 Digital.
Yep.
But then we have our small grant program, which is Dynamic 4 Good. So there's a few different, you know, don't tend to use them that much, because otherwise there's just too many brands in play.
Yeah, yeah.
Or sub-brands. But yeah, that's the general thinking, yeah, where it originated from.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the things that you do, because you mentioned human-centered design here, and it's one of the, you know, things that are front and center if you look at your services on your website, which we'll obviously link up listeners to from the show page. But for those listeners that may not be aware, what is human-centered design? What does it seek to achieve?
Yeah, so it is kind of in the name, thankfully. So it's really the human-centered, and using people and understanding people as, you know, in a very deep and empathic way. And then using those insights and ideally collaborating and co-designing with those people to then design and build their own solutions, or solutions that they have agency over and a lot more self-directed, and which, you know, from a straight business perspective as well, that means they're much more likely to be adopted when it's solving a real problem that matters. And that's not a real problem that matters because I think it is. But, you know, I might start out with a hypothesis of,
yeah,
I think this is a really massive issue and we need to do something about it. But what happens, you know, straight away, still, as soon as you go and talk with people who are your target audience and customers, and you test some of your thinking, and then one of the very first things that almost always happens, pretty much always happens, is your language refines. So the terms and the way you phrase things, that's immediately you realize you've been using the wrong word that doesn't resonate with that target group of people, and this is actually how they describe their situation and how they think of it. Starts exposing their mental models and how they see the world, what they, you know, how they think, feel, behave, what they expect, what motivates them. And these are all the things that we need to, you know, have empathy with and really deeply understand, to then make sure that we're actually solving problems that matter. Hmm. And then as we then go into solution mode, that we're actually taking, you know, keeping those insights and testing the thinking. And so that's kind of that end-to-end process. It doesn't stop with what some people might think of as design, of kind of something that's shiny and colorful and get your crayons out.
Yeah.
But design as a, this is how it works. This is the experience end-to-end.
Yeah. So I was going to come onto the design word, because that means different things to different people, depending on where you come from. You know, you've got graphic designers, you've got kind of solution designers, you've got social service designers, you've got technical designers. So which do you do all of those things? Do you use all those bits to deliver your
Yep, it's design is a very holistic, ultimately design is a problem solving process.
Yeah.
And it produces different artifacts or products.
Yeah.
Of which you just listed a whole bunch. And especially, you know, designing businesses and doing business model innovation and design, you're then looking at all of those elements, including the graphics and the digital interfaces and the non-digital parts of the experience. So especially working on early stage startups, social enterprises, you're going through that process, and design literally means everything, whatever is going to be the solution, and not just what's going to be the solution, but also the process of working out what is this problem and do we really understand it? Is it the right one to solve?
Yeah.
So solving the right problem, and then it translates into then solving the problem right, that solution side of things.
And do you then take, obviously, to do that work with your customers and your startups and your social enterprises, once you've come up with a design, whether it's digital or non-digital or you know, technology or people or whatever it is, do you then, is that where the coaching side comes in to help implement that? Do you do the technology implementation? How does that kind of piece work?
Yeah, so it's yes is the short version of the answer. And the ratios of each of those components are sort of evolved and transitioned over the years. So yeah. Historically used to do a much more sort of traditional consulting model of still doing it in the human-centered way, and because that includes being taking a human-centered approach to how we work with our clients as well.
Yeah.
So working with our clients, understanding their context and the business opportunity or problem that they're looking to address, but then sort of doing the work for them and not necessarily alongside them, yeah. And then sort of bringing it back and then, you know, that more traditional consulting type approach. But now it's a lot more coaching as the primary way of getting these things done and more of a focus on helping organizations build that internal capability. Mm. So there's that maturity and some skills and being more self-sufficient internally, which also then results in more continuity and actually being in control of their own organization.
Yeah.
And the role that's then plays more alongside and with, as opposed to for, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so one of the things you mentioned just in passing there was that you do sustainable business models. And I think most listeners will know, you know, business model, business plan, business structure, whatever. But the sustainable bit is the bit that makes it slightly different and slightly tricky, maybe. What's your experience of that?
Yes, so the word sustainable, obviously multiple meanings in different contexts,
yeah.
And even in this context it has two kind of meanings as well, which I think you're sort of alluding to. So often talking in the specifically about business models and sustainable, generally the primary use is and or meaning is that it is financially sustainable and can be ongoing and continue.
Yeah.
And obviously, with social enterprise and also not-for-profits, you know, purpose-driven organizations who exist to deliver on a specific social environmental purpose, that is a key focus and the primary reason for being. And historically, they're not been that awesome at the sort of commercial side and the financial viability. And, you know, something that's definitely very strong in Australia, but it's a global sort of trend, is that grants and donations are much harder to come by, or at least a lot more variable than they have been historically.
Yeah.
So it starts to become literally an existential risk to organisations relying on grants and donations as their only way of keeping the lights on.
Yeah.
So how might we, as a organisation who's purpose-driven, then diversify our revenue streams and have some earned income streams by having a, you know, a product or service, some kind of offering that we're then selling. And what happens there a lot is a not-for-profit might, you know, be approached to see an opportunity and sort of an opportunity that's off the side and it's not actually aligned to their core purpose and their theory of change. And it doesn't necessarily leverage the strengths and assets that the organization already has. So it becomes a distraction at best, quite often becomes a cash drain rather than something that's actually going to help with sustainability financially. So that's something we do a lot of work with organizations to help them identify opportunities that is the opposite of that, that it actually does align with their core purpose. And it's also then helping keep the lights on and be financially sustainable. And then there's the other meaning of sustainable in kind of environmental sustainability and sustainability in its original meaning of, you know, looking at people and culture as part of sustainability, which tends to be left out of the common use of how sustainability is used as a word in that context now.
Yeah.
But and that's where that B Corp perspective, especially in that triple bottom line of people, planet and profit, really comes in. So there's no point having a business model that isn't looking after people and planet while you make money. And that's just not good business anymore anyway. The expectations of customers, of talented team members and of investors is increasingly expecting that you're doing the right thing by people, you've got a social license to operate, you're doing the right things by the planet, and if you're not doing those things, you're actually a bad financial risk and operational reputational risk as well. So, you know, there's a massive swing there, and you know, straight from a market dynamics aspect of it, those levers are starting to get pulled, not because everyone suddenly cares and all these CEOs and investors have turned into hippies. They're doing it out of straight risk management. But it is having a positive set of expectations and getting even mainstream businesses to start adapting and evolving they operate.
It's not necessarily because they care. Their customers more and more care about these things. So they have to change, not just because...
Exactly. Those pressures of customers and talents put big levers, a lot of pressure on them.
Yeah. So the way that you do that environmental, social sustainability side of the business model, has that been informed by your experience with B Corps, and how similar is that kind of work?
Very entwined, but kind of we're all focused on social impact and social enterprise pre-certifying as a B Corp as well. So like probably the majority of B Corps, it was a way to getting our B Corp certification was a way to formalize and have some external, you know, auditing and benchmarking of what we're effectively already doing. So certify, we didn't have to change anything. We just had to document some things and put our case forward in the impact assessment of where we're at and why and show evidence for. And then obviously, like every B Corp, every time we recertify, we're looking to lift the bar and be continually improving in terms of how we operate. It was the B Corp cert was definitely more to formalize that and primarily about the community around B Corps. We've got a great community here in Sydney and in Australia. We're kind of lucky, very early adopters in terms of B Corp certification globally outside of the US.
Well,
and we've always had...
Yeah, 5 years is 5 years ago is you were quite early. So it was, what were you thinking?
And not that early for Australia.
Okay.
So I actually started the B Corp cert process probably about 4 years before that. Just never got to the top of the to-do list. And I had some stuff in the impact assessment where I went and did a masterclass that B-Lab put on and then just cruised through the impact assessment. And that was it. But
so you're saying
we've been lucky in that we've had about 10% of the global population has consistently been in Australia. So we're very overrepresented globally in that context, which is great.
So you started your B Corp journey 9 years ago. I mean, that you're an old man in B Corp terms, I think. I'm really interested that that length of time ago, certainly in the UK and around Europe, and even in the US, I was working with people in the US, that it wasn't nearly so well known and acknowledged as it is now. And I'm wondering, what it was 9 years ago that led you to think, oh, this is something I need to look at.
Yeah, I think part of it is that sense of finding a tribe and, working with other like-minded, values-aligned business leaders and owners and, a great group of people and a tight community. And obviously, as the audience grows and the membership grows, which is awesome. That community grows and then you're always meeting new people. And it's just a great community to be part of. And that for me has been the primary value is, having other great people to bounce ideas off and just hang out with, even if we're not talking B Corp and business stuff, just a great group of people to hang out with.
Yeah. So how many have you got in Sydney? What sort of number of B Corps are there?
It's always a little bit hard to split it out city by city because of, you know, headquartering and things like that. So globally, it's just under 4,000 now, is that right?
Yeah.
It's like 3,800 or something. And I think we're about 380 odds in Australia. Sort of in that ballpark in Australia, New Zealand, mostly in Australia. And then I think the ballparking was somewhere around maybe 100 to 150 in Sydney.
Wow. It's a sizable community. And I can agree that being part of the community is one of the major benefits of the B Corp.
And I think something that's been a really positive thing over the last sort of 2-3 years is it opening up the community as well. So historically it was kind of more certified B Corp people would hang out and it would just be us talking to ourselves. But we put on a few events over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
It's always hard gauging timelines now with 2020 distorting everything. But sort of 2-3 years ago, putting on a bunch of events where we also had lots of people who were interested in starting on their B Corp journey or somewhere on it and weren't yet certified. So, sort of opening the arms a little wider and welcoming people in and letting them sort of see what that journey looks like and hear what some of those different people's experience has been, and just broadening the awareness, which I think is a really important step.
Absolutely. So if I'm a startup social enterprise and I'm looking for some help, what are the things that Dynamic 4 can do for me?
Yeah, so one of the key things that we do is run an incubator called Jetpack for early stage social enterprise. And a key definition of term here as well is early stage. So especially in social enterprise sort of context, early stage can be anything from someone's just had the idea and they just started the journey, but far more often they've actually been on the journey for 2, 3, 5, 7 years.
Yeah.
And just not getting that sort of traction and cut through. Yeah. And invariably got other full-time personal commitments, if that's work or family or accommodation. Mm. And so it's sort of all happening on the side. So getting, sort of building that momentum is a key challenge and sort of carving out some dedicated headspace. Mm. So the way we run Jetpack is very much a coaching model. So rather than being a hard, strict curriculum and a set timeline, it's more of a self-paced type model. Mm. And it's trying to, a key focus is helping people focus on the right things now and do the right things at the right time, rather than what often happens with different programs is, it's week 3 of the program. So this is a topic and you have to do sort of this assignment on the accelerator, otherwise you get kicked out, even though I'm nowhere near ready for it. Yeah. So it's, one of the key design principles of the program is to really help people do the right things at the right time, build that, the confidence and the momentum. To be honest, all of the information is out there on the internet and in books. And that's also a key challenge that people get lost in all of these different frameworks and models.
Yeah.
So to be able to sort of cut through the noise and have, here's a known path and taking that human-centered approach to design and innovation, then coaching people and being alongside people on that journey.
And I think also, Ben, and for listeners, it's unusual to find a design coaching consultancy that is specialized in helping social enterprises, because there's an awful lot of business coaches and designers and things out there, but they are experienced in for-profit in whatever sector they specialize in. They're not in the social enterprise space. I think you've got something a bit unique about the sort of things that you do.
And a lot of that's focused there through experience of starting social enterprises and startups, and I started my first startup 26 almost 27 years ago, and going through that cycle of some very hard and painful lessons and making the same or very similar mistakes over and over, being able to share that pain and things that I've found to work and questions I ask myself regularly, to then be able to help, you know, founders and leaders ask themselves those questions. Yeah. And guide them through that process. And, you know, a key part of that journey is knowing when to stop. You know, sometimes, because it's a process of learning, and sometimes the thing you learn is the thing I really care about and my idea, no one wants. And it's not a problem that's worth solving, or the people who I thought were experiencing a problem, they're getting by and they're fine, and there's no desire to actually switch and change the behavior. So there are times where you just have to grieve it. It's a grieving process when you wind one down, and let it go, and, you know, work out what you do next, which might be another attempt at something.
I can absolutely vouch for that. We had a product that everybody needed, but nobody wanted. And it's a tough one, and you have to walk away. And
it hurts.
Yeah, it does.
It really hurts. And it's something that you want to learn as early in the journey, early with the least time and money spent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the less amount of attachment, the least amount of attachment you can have to it, the easier it is if you have to grieve it.
Yeah.
And we sort of love our ideas and we hold them a bit too close often. So a lot of the, you know, working with founders, it is helping them through that process, including sometimes going, okay, for various reasons, I can't do it anymore, and being able to let that go and be supported through that process, and that there's not an expectation that every startup will work, and that another one that's often sort of expected, even if it's only sort of implicitly, is that every social enterprise or startup has to scale and be this global thing, which tends to be a lot of pressure there, where quite often that wouldn't be the right thing from multiple perspectives.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. Ben, we're asking all of our guests if they've got a takeaway tip or an action that listeners can go away to do. So I'm wondering if you've got something you could suggest for us.
Something to look for or do?
Yeah.
So a tip. Okay. So it's B Corp month, as we know. So I think one thing that we can definitely all do is look for the B Corp mark. So that little B Corp trust mark, that symbol, and just look out for it. So when you do your reticular activating system, the RAS, you start looking for it. You see one, then you start seeing them everywhere.
You do, yeah.
So if you can get the RAS working, and then sort of start noticing, you know, our individual customers, where are they seeing it out in the world? Are they in shopping centers? Are they on different places and in the office and email footers? Like, where are these bees and what are they up to? And is there something that you can do either in your personal or professional life to preference B Corps and social enterprises in your supply chain and support them both with your wallet?
That's a great one. I don't know if they've got anything like this over in Australia, but in the UK, a few of the big supermarkets have now launched B Corp only sections in their store, B Corp only on their online shop. So when you see the products, it's only products from B Corp. So, you know, there's a few retailers.
Nothing like that in Australia. That's awesome.
I think there's one that's got a B Corp aisle. So you go into the physical store and walk down the aisle, it's only B Corp products. So, great tip. If you can interact with, buy from B Corps, then would wholeheartedly. Absolutely. And we're also, Ben, asking our guests for any recommendation of a book or a video, a film or anything like that listeners can go away and have a read of or have a look at. Is there something you can suggest for us?
There are many.
Yes. Lots of guests have said, can I have two? <But
that's... laughs> I'll try and limit myself to one.
Okay.
And maybe tease a second. The drawdown report. Has that come up multiple times yet?
No, no, it hasn't.
I recommend checking out the drawdown, Project Drawdown in the book.
Yep.
Just done a really amazing job of looking at all of the causes of climate change and issues,
yep.
and then all of the various solutions, and 100% evidence-based of where are the biggest impacts to be had, and then what can we as individuals, you know, choose something, and it might start with a small action and make it a habit, encourage others in your household, but obviously most of those environmental issues and the climate action we need to take are, they need much bigger action, but our own personal decisions take a, you know, they help create the movement, yeah. the conditions and the expectations amongst companies, as we were sort of talking about earlier, but also governments. Yeah. And voting with your wallet along that is another powerful action.
Yeah.
But yeah, we need to create that that momentum. Mm. And a big one that I think is often overlooked as part of that is that we often talk about companies as sort of a faceless entity, but they're actually made up of groups of people.
Yeah.
And so all of us, if we, you know, especially where we're influencing and making decisions in those contexts, decide to solve problems that matter in more empathic and innovative ways and actively measure what success means, not just in terms of money, but also outcomes for people and our planet, then, you know, that cumulative action by individuals inside these entities also has the power to have massive
yeah.
change as well. So that's a big focus area for me.
Absolutely, millions of small actions to make the change. But Project Drawdown is a great one, and nobody's recommended it yet. So we'll link that up. we'll link that up in the show, in the show notes. So that's a really good
actually,
one.
I'll tease one more.
Okay.
I'm currently writing a book called Solve Problems That Matter, which is a social enterprise guide to human-centered design and innovation. So it's the book format, basically, of our Jetpack incubator program. So the idea is there to get it out to more people globally so they can access it and have that as a pathway to be on that journey as well.
Great. Well, if it's not ready when this show goes live, we'll make sure we share it when it is ready. So,
awesome.
No, great. And so, listeners, we'll put all the things we've discussed in the show page, and we'll put links out so you can go and find them. If listeners want to get hold of Dynamic 4, Ben, or reach out to you, where's the best places for them to do that?
So our website is dynamic4.com.
Okay.
And a bunch of stuff there.
Yep.
Not as much stuff as there will be. It's always on a to-do list.
Yeah,
to have more
yeah.
there. But one of the best ways is probably to connect with me on LinkedIn.
Okay.
Ben Pecotich, P-E-C-O-T-I-C-H. I think I might be the only one on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
It's a relatively rare name, so
good.
Generally pretty easy to find.
Yeah, well, we'll put links to all those social and the website and things in the show notes. So if listeners want to go and link up with Ben, then you can do so from there. Now it's time for the favorite part of the show. It's fact or fake, and I was on a bit of a losing streak, but I had a win yesterday, so my confidence levels have improved. So today on fact or fake, we're going to do social enterprises, which is something we've been discussing a lot. So I've got some statements about social enterprises for you, Ben. Are you ready?
Oh, no. No, I really feel under pressure.
Okay, so your first statement is, half of all social enterprises are 5 years old or less. Is that a fact or is it a fake?
It would depend on the data source. I'm going to give you a depends to probably all of these questions.
this is worldwide. This is a study.
I would say it's likely to be a fact, and if it's not a fact, it would be an issue of labeling and people self-identifying as a social enterprise when they are.
You've covered your bases, but you were correct. It is a fact. Is that it's actually 49%, but we'll call that half. But yeah, 49% of all social enterprises are 5 years old or less. So it's a, you know, it's a really new, you know, new and growing thing. Okay, here's a UK-based one now, but hopefully you have some insight to the UK. 10% of social enterprises in the UK are led by women.
I would say and thoroughly hope that is false. And I would say that it's much, if it's anything like Australia, I, without having actual data, would guess it to be 60 to 70% would be okay. Female-led social enterprises. And I would at least hope it's much higher than 10% in the UK.
Okay,
so I'm going to optimistically say false.
So you're correct. It is a fake. So I lose. I'll be playing for consolation in the last one. But it is more. It's actually 40%, which isn't as high as the 60. So it's 40%. But actually, that is way more than we've got in the FTSE 100 board, or you know,
definitely.
Company. So.
There's so many amazing women leaders in social enterprise. Yeah. It's, awesome.
So it's good to see the diversity and leadership of social enterprise. So that's, you know, a really positive thing. And finally, for consolation for me, if I can get it. here we go. So social entrepreneurs comprise 5% of all entrepreneurs in the world. Is that a fact?
Say it again.
Social entrepreneurs comprise 5% of all entrepreneurs in the world.
From that statement, is there a definition of when somebody stops being an entrepreneur? Is entrepreneur someone that has started a business of any kind?
Yeah.
Or is it in a startup phase only?
No, there's no.
There's no upper limit?
No, there's no.
My gut feel is it would be lower than 5% globally.
It's actually 5%. So
is it?
A small consolation for me, but I mean, it's
that's good.
Yeah, it's okay. I think I would say but it's not enough. It's only 5% of all.
And it's still and there's definitely some challenges there. One around what is a social enterprise? that's. There's sort of two pretty much universally agreed attributes and then the third one that gets debated heavily.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, for one reason or another, don't self-identify as a social enterprise as well. So I think, you know, the numbers would be higher, but overall it's still a relatively emergent practice.
It is,
in a lot of centres.
And I think whilst I'm smarting from defeat and you're basking in victory, I think we can both agree on the fact that we'd like more social entrepreneurs in the world. And that would be
we need it. And for it to become mainstream, you know, ideally to the point that there isn't a separate category or name for it.
Yeah.
That it just becomes standard practice that businesses are looking after people on planet and are very clear on that purpose rather than profit at all costs.
Yeah, great. Ben, it's been great to talk to you today. I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, I wish you all the success with Dynamic 4 in the future and your continued B Corp journey. Thanks for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been great to have a chat. Look forward to chatting again.
Great. We really hope that you found this special B Corp Month episode both informative and entertaining. Make sure you don't miss any of the other 31 interviews with B Corporations who are striving to be a force for good. So make sure you subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss a thing. And don't forget to spread the word with others. If you have any questions about being or becoming a B Corp or any comments and suggestions about the show, please do get in touch. You can email studio@greenelephant.show or visit our website greenelephant.show. Or find us on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube or Twitter by searching for Green Elipod or The Green Elephant Show. You can also review the show on Google and Apple Podcasts. Join us tomorrow and we hope you have a sustainable day.